Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The Arab Gulf states, Oman, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates are more culturally and economically diverse than you might think. And this has ramifications for countries all around the world, including our own. Dr. Sean Foley, Assistant Professor of History at MTSU, has a new book called The Arab Gulf States, Beyond Oil and Islam, in which he describes all sorts of dynamics that are changing the way we think about these countries and the way they think about themselves. Thanks for being with us again, Sean.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you. It's always good to see you in person, and of course, on the occasion of my new book coming out, always a good thing.
It's my pleasure, too. This is from Lynn Reiser Press?
Reiner Press, actually, which is based in Colorado. It's also up on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, so if you're interested in hearing more about what I have to say today, it is available online or through the press. Lynn Reiner, and that's spelled...
R-I-E-N-N-E-R?
That's right. Right.
Lynn Reiner Press. Okay.
That's right.
Great. Sorry about that. When we think about this six-nation region, we tend to think oil, oil, oil. But oil is still major, but there's still like a societal sea change going on that has slipped under the radar, involving the emerging role of women, the news media, and people of non-Arab ethnicity. So share with us the basic premise of your book with that as a jumping-off point.
When we think about this region, we tend to begin and end our sentences with both oil and Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two things. And I'm asking the basic question of this book is, can we think about this region without beginning or ending our discussions with Islam? Indeed, mm-hmm. Islam can explain to us why a major circulation Saudi newspaper regularly publishes satellite television programs and employed an openly gay writer, even though both homosexuality and satellite television were both technically illegal in the kingdom.
Yes.
And the way I answer that is by saying, well, oil is an important thing. Don't be clear. This is why these states play a dominant role in the international economy, not only oil, but also that oil has given them tremendous resources to be in major investment players throughout the world. There's no question. But to understand the answer to that question that I said about Saudi Arabia, we need to step back and say, are there other things going on in these societies? Indeed, in the United States, oil is central to our daily life and has indeed been central for nearly 50 to 60 years. Yet we don't see oil as the central element in society, even though the price of oil is something we all care about deeply.
Yeah. And the governments of these nations, one wonders why that if oil and Islam are both so important to them, why they have not developed some sort of totalitarian tactics or some kind of theocratic crackdown to enforce certain cultural norms. Would that be counterproductive at this point, or do they realize it's in their best interest to keep the dichotomy
going? These are states that are monarchies. They're, for instance, all six states are monarchies in one sense of the word or another. There are mm-hmm. some states, particularly Bahrain and Kuwait, that have some direct democratic governance as well. As part of Kuwait, for instance, has a very lively political process. So let's be clear. These are monarchies, and in fact, these are unique monarchies because with the exception of Morocco, these are the only states in the region governing families that have a role in governance that predates World War I. And these people have been in governing business for a long time. But the type of governance and monarchy that they have is a very different one than our traditional perspective. We tend, first of all, they're governing over societies in which they're very diverse, but where there's a tradition of direct governance. We can't, for instance, call or directly visit the President of the United States, but in almost any of these states, if you want to visit the king or your local provincial official or prince, you can do so. Indeed, in the UAE, for many years, the emir's, the sultan's sort of president's main phone number was listed in the phone book.
There is a sort of representative democratic model on some level, unlike Iraq, which had no democratic model whatsoever, right?
Actually, I'd be very careful about that. Iraq has actually had a tradition of a semi-democratic governance even before the onset of the 1960s. There actually were regular elections held in Iraq, for instance. However, they would best be called controlled democracy, might be the best way of describing it, where a small percentage of the population would participate. But these states, yes, have, in terms of theory, a direct line of governance, an idea that there are tribal communities and that there are reciprocal arrangements that need to be in place, that it has to be not only that a person is ruled, but other people have to give the right, give the authority to that person to govern.
Now, initially, from the 30s on, there was a system by which if you were from outside the country and you wanted to come in to work, say for an oil company or something, you had to have a representative that was sort of, you were sort of renting people in the
sure.
kafala system. And there was a great deal of control over people coming in.
Absolutely. The kafala system has been there for a long time, although I would argue that if you look at the longer term structures of the way these societies have worked, they've always worked that way. Mm-hmm. And that they've been very, even before the rise of the oil industry, this region has been closely tied to the global economy. Indeed, you know, before the beginning of the 20th century, the Gulf was effectively part of a greater British Empire.
Right.
And if they needed goods or services, they would import people, mainly from places like India or what we know today as Pakistan. And so this idea of the kafala culture, of other people doing work, of Indians or others doing work, is actually not a new one at all. Indeed, Jewish pearl merchants, for instance, were an active participant in this region. If you looked at healthcare in the first half of the 20th century in this part of the world, from about 1890 to about 1950, it's carried out overwhelmingly by Christian missionaries.
Yeah, but then this has morphed into what the what it was some kind of like, as I read it, a sort of indentured servitude, especially with the kind of physical brutality that could be imposed upon
sure.
the person.
But in terms of that system in terms of the, first of all, that system always had limits. That's the first thing with it. And indeed, while that indentured servitude may seem to be in place, the kafala system, these states also allowed for at the same time an enormous amount of political and what best would be called cultural space.
Mm-hmm.
Look at an example like Kuwait. Kuwait is where the kafala system ground zero, you could say. But at the same time, the Kuwaiti government is spending tons of money and giving actual land for Catholics to build cathedrals.
Yeah.
Not only give the cathedrals, but the Catholic Church is going to give virtually every single lay honor that a person can receive within the Catholic Church to laymen is given to the royal family of Kuwait in gratitude for the amount of work that's being done. And it's not just in Kuwait, it's also in Bahrain. There's a long tradition. In Qatar recently just opened up a Catholic church. And even within Saudi Arabia, we think of Saudi Arabia as a religiously conservative society, even to the point of intolerance. And in certain ways, that conservatism is very real. It is the home of Mecca and Medina. But in the oil company zones, in the oil company Aramco zones, there were tens of thousands of expatriates, Catholics. Indeed, there were regularly Catholic priests who were sent to this part of the world and actively gave Christian services in this part of the world. And indeed, if you look at Mormons, for instance, or other types of people, had, one could argue, more religious freedom in this part of the world, cultural space, mm-hmm. than they would in other parts of the Middle East.
So even though this is a transition that has flown under the radar, there is a historical continuum here of sorts.
Absolutely. And although the kafala system, in terms of the way the system worked, would be awful, particularly for, say, certain classes of the population. If you are, say, effectively a servant of a family, for instance, or other types of things, you could be open to physical abuse. At the same time, that has to be balanced against a historical continuity of tolerance. That's one of the key arguments I make, is that we think of this region as intolerant, but in reality, it is a region that is successfully integrated, not without some problems, large amounts of people from virtually everywhere in the world.
So how did this escape Western notice, especially the notice of Western journalism? And it can't be as simple as just 9/11.
Well, first of all, we've only, for this region is, first of all, far away from the rest of the Middle East. Most people like me who are Middle Eastern Arab specialists are trained and go to places like Cairo and Damascus, Beirut, places that are far away from the Gulf. And indeed, the Gulf is seen as hot, and until quite recently was a not pleasant place to live. Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, a lot of Western trained scholars, even like me, aren't going to spend time in this region or have direct connections to it. And second, scholars are trained to look at very specific great power things, journalists. So they're going to look at oil.
Mm-hmm.
Oil and Islam are an easy thing to sort of focus your eyes on as a glowing light that prevents you from seeing just about anything else. And indeed, also when people would travel, particularly journalists are not necessarily rewarded for knowing local languages. So when they show up, they're going to learn, they're going to have someone working with them, a translator, usually appointed by the government, who's going to tell them what the government wants them to see. And that government isn't necessarily interested in having an American journalist see anything other than what that government wants to see.
It would behoove us, though, to pay more attention to the diversity and the tolerance that are in these six countries, however, because it would help us as Americans disabuse ourselves of certain stereotypes that seem to prevent prevail in the popular culture.
Absolutely. And these are parts of the world that we are going to have to deal with. A, they are the center of the global oil industry. There's no question, particularly Saudi Arabia, the largest exporter. They're also a major source of foreign investment. And as America integrates further every day into the global economy, there are articles that have been recently done in the Tennessean about how much foreign investment we have here. Openness to other parts of the world and our ability to understand people who have money that might be invested in Tennessee is a good thing.
Yeah. Let's talk about women. You state that younger women are more literate in this area and they stay in school longer than their male counterparts. Why?
Why? There are a host of reasons for that. To begin with, women have a long tradition in this part of the world. We tend to look at it particularly with the veil. Again, the veil is a bit like oil in Islam. It tends to blind our lights, blind our vision of the world. But the women in this part of the world have a long tradition of being politically active, of being economically active, of being socially active, playing in various roles in this part of the world. And indeed, women have a long tradition. And it's not just in the Gulf, should I mind you. The statistics of the Gulf say 60% of schools, for instance, today, enrollments, if not higher, are women, are identical to other parts of the world. If you look at, say, Georgia or Tennessee, our numbers of school students in schools are identical to that of women in the Gulf.
That's absolutely amazing. What is the reaction of the male population to this emergence?
Well, this is a problem. this is becoming one of the key issues identifies when we think about gender in this part of the world. We begin and end with women, but in reality, men are far more important and more interesting. For them, for many years, men have always had the opportunities to work in either family businesses or in the army or military. And the way the societies are structured, that's been an easy out for them to do. But as these societies have modernized, as these societies have, particularly once money came in from oil, and they decided to build industries, more modern industries, not directly related with oil, these guys don't have the jobs. And indeed, this is not a new problem. As early as the 1950s, British officials visiting schools in the Gulf recognized that all the high school level and above classes were dominated by women.
It sounds almost analogous to the American issue of the majority of women in colleges and universities, majority of students in colleges and universities now being women.
Oh, sure.
And it's been attributed by sociologists and psychologists to, well, things like women mature, girls mature faster than boys, so forth and so on. I wonder if it's analogous across the levels or if there's something unique to the culture in the Gulf Arab states that factors in here.
I think I would argue it's a combination of both. I mean, it's worth noting. I mean, there was a report that came out that I note at the end of my text from Georgia, which called last year for redoing the whole Georgia social system because it said a majority of our men in Georgia are becoming effectively structurally unemployable. In other words, they're never going to get jobs again. And that's the exact same thing that's going on in the Gulf. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the trends over the last, since the 70s, are identical. Statistics are absolutely identical. So I would say certainly the culture has to do with it. And this is a culture in which both women and men encourage each other to work. And where women have, particularly if they have strong relations with their fathers, mm-hmm. can encourage that type of working forward.
Do the fathers behave in a mentoring type way to their daughters?
Absolutely. And you can see this both in a whole range of things. In the movie that I showed at the Honors College called Kefal Hall, I showed a scene where there's a young woman who drives in Saudi Arabia, and she does so clearly, the scene shows, with her father's consent.
Yeah.
It's a loving scene. I should add also that in recent years, women have emerged, again, because they are women tend to excel in climates where they can be, even with math and science, where they're going to benefit from two things. One is from family connections. Indeed, in the Islamic tradition, women have always had a lot of inheritance. In fact, inheritance laws in Islam were significantly superior to those in the Western tradition, including that of France, until quite recently. So they have a lot of money already. Indeed, the majority of the landowners in places like Riyadh or Jeddah, Saudi Arabia's two largest cities, are women. That's mm-hmm. a good place to start in business. If you've got money, you can make a lot more. The other reason is that these states recognize, particularly since 9/11, that women offer them a less austere, less threatening message, and that if the vision of the world that investors have in places like Tokyo or London or New York is 9/11, bringing a woman, even if a woman with a hijab, into the room as your representative changes the whole discussion.
Yes. Do the women who make it then in turn act as mentors to other women on the way up?
Yes, absolutely. A good example is Lubna Olayan, who's the head of Olayan Investment Groups, which is Saudi Arabia's largest conglomerate company, gave a major speech in 2004 calling for women to have a greater place in Saudi society and has indeed actively worked to mentor young women. No question. I should add there's also another political reason to this, which is that Islamic groups that tend to voice their concerns about these societies, accuse governments of not being sufficiently Islamic, often couch their language in patriarchal terms, misogynistic terms. So that means that if you're going to counter that, if you're a government, women are a very natural ally.
Okay, I get that. But then there are so many mistakes made about characterizing Islam and so many mischaracterizations and stereotypes about Islam that one would get the idea that it's a misogynistic religion, would you not, if you did not actually study it in detail?
Sure. Again, first of all, we have a vision, both societies. Islam, like Christianity, like other religions, is a religion that has multiple ways of looking at it, a long history of tradition where people have interpreted a series of texts, particularly holy texts, in a great way. But when one looks at Islam, indeed, it's worth noting the first convert to the Islamic faith is a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Islam also promises, in terms of talks about maturity, talks about things being to both men and for women. Ask for modesty, the rules that come towards the veiling and that type of control come of verses and other types of things that talk specifically about both men and women are expected to ask modesty. If I can add to this, when I talk about my book about gender, one of the things I noticed that if you take a look at pictures of men from this part of the world, they're wearing these long head things plus huge long flowing outfits.
Right.
If you look at what they're wearing, it covers as much of the body as what women are expected to wear.
Right. So not only marital fidelity is expected of both genders, but modesty is expected
that's
of both
correct.
Genders.
That's correct. And that's something worth noting. Indeed, there's been a lot of research done on women in Saudi Arabia and the veil, and that's important. The symbol of veil has been seen as a symbol of the Islamic woman versus the decadent West. Okay. But same thing for men. If you fly on a plane to the Gulf,
mm-hmm.
Worst thing to do is get to a bathroom at the end of the flight. Why?
Why?
Everybody's changing.
Uh-huh.
From their Western outfits to their Islamic outfits, and that's both men and women.
So if you have to urinate, just get off the plane and go in the airport.
Something like that. Or do it before that. But that type of thing. I when I first went to the Gulf, I saw that. I'm like, what's going on here? Why are these people at the bathroom? And then I realized, oh, they're all changing. If you take a look at that outfit, again, with men. When Saudi Arabia unifies itself in 1932, they build this huge, enormous kingdom, the first thing they really do is they say all men in the kingdom must look like the men who dress in Riyadh, the capital. And this old, if you go back in Saudi, you will see pictures of older outfits of men from different parts of the kingdom from before the 1930s. They're colorful, nothing like the white outfits of today.
Wow.
Same thing. When the states unify in the Gulf,
mm-hmm.
Particularly Bahrain, one of my favorite stories, when Bahrain joins Saudi Arabia and other states in the early 1980s in this new council called the Gulf Cooperation Council Unity, idea that becomes something like the European Union in the Middle East, Bahraini men who would look dressed like what I'm wearing today, trousers and a shirt, switched from that to wearing the long white robes. Again, back in the 50s, they had left the white robes to join Western clothing. And when they joined the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, it was important for them to look like their Saudi brethren and to switch.
In unity, there is a certain amount of conformity.
Absolutely. And the fact that it's not just women, it's also men.
Yes. Let's talk about the men for a minute. In your recent honors lecture, you showed a video of drifting, which looks like a bunch of knuckleheads got drunk and went out to the Bonneville Salt Flats and just sort of scooted around in these cars. Or maybe it's early NASCAR without the moonshine.
Sure. I mean, first of all, I've talked to my students about this, and they have plenty of examples of people doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when kids are bored in parking lots with cars,
yeah.
They're going to do some crazy things.
This is your basic 18 to 24-year-old boy with an adrenaline rush, and he's got to do something.
Right. And this is actually part and parcel of what I mentioned earlier about gender being both men and women, and why men are so interesting to study. Drifting, of course, is this idea that men are going at high speeds. What's also important is the 21st century aspect of it, which is that they're up on YouTube videos.
Yes.
And often, supposedly, they get their pick of young men. Again, we talked about homosexuality.
Right.
There's a reason why I mentioned that. And it's indicative of larger social problems, which is that these young men who can't compete in modern workforces, who may find limited jobs in government or family businesses, can't necessarily have the resource to marry without state support, have a lot of time on their hands. And they're going to fall into bad habits like truancy, like petty crime, like graffiti, and like drifting.
Well, you said also American companies like Red Bull and Chevrolet are sponsoring some of these drifting matches or drifting races. What do they get out of it?
Well, Red Bull and Chevrolet, well, first of all, Chevrolet, it's cars. Red Bull, because it's the type of, this is their core market, right?
Yeah. But what does an American company get out of the stupefying, if you will, of young Arab men?
Money. Money, sure. I mean, look, it's marketing. I mean, they have every right to market to a market, and they're not telling students to necessarily do this. And in fact, they would probably argue that these young men are being given a safe place to do this. But look, you know, that they're marketing it in the same way that they market various types of products to other types of societies. And let's be clear. Yes, there are young men, but also a lot of these people are 18, 19, 20, 21. They're young adults, but the important part of that expression is adults. And look, do we believe that people should make choices? Yeah. And unfortunately, they also make bad choices.
Well, most of the cars I saw are white. So if they want to be like NASCAR, they should get their sponsors' logos on the sides of the cars. And that'll probably be the next step, right?
That's already been done in certain races.
Already been done?
But the important thing about that is that when we look at men, when we take a gender, we tend to think about women and about pulling them out, you know, giving them equality and all those things and giving women a better place. I'm actually arguing in the future, women are well positioned to take advantage of the modern economy. They're the ones with the skill sets. They're the ones who speak the foreign languages. They're the ones who are going to be okay in the future. The young men are the real problem. That the young men are the ones, we think of these as being male. Remember, these are societies that still seemingly are male-dominated, yet it's the young men who've got the real issues. These are the ones who want to prevent from doing bad things to themselves, like racing over a cliff or crashing at high speeds or joining a terrorist organization. And indeed, it's very interesting to watch these societies over the last 4 to 5 years develop mechanisms to sort of bring these guys back in. Indeed, Saudi Arabia, when it retrains terrorists, effectively reprograms people and then follows these guys every step of the way. They remarry them, they get them a Toyota Corolla, just like in the video, and they marry them and they closely monitor them to get them out of those bad influences.
With regard to the impact of communication, do you think that there was a nation-building effort on the part of the West, a la Radio Free Europe, or more recent unilateral action, or was it just an inevitable byproduct of the commercial interaction that the mass media would have the impact that it did?
Oh, absolutely. Let's back up. This is a great thing that you brought up. I'm glad you did. Two things are, we tend to think of oil as being the only thing that dominates this part of the world. And in fact, technology, one being air conditioning. Could you imagine living in 100-degree weather without air conditioning?
Just like in the American South, it was revolutionized by air conditioning.
Absolutely. Just like here. Is that, you know, famously said, Washington was a hardship post for foreign diplomats before the development of air conditioning. But also, media technology is important. It's been the case for a long time. Both radio and television predate even Radio Free Europe. Indeed, we're talking in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. These are regions that are going to have radio. And indeed, because there are a whole bunch of people who live right next to each other, it's actually analogous, I'm glad you brought up Radio Free Europe, to Germany during the Cold War.
Yeah.
Because you've got two populations, large populations in different states that sit right next to each other, that speak the same language, but don't necessarily have the same ideas of the world.
Right.
And so the media can cross over. We think of Al Jazeera and its ability to project into the Middle East, into these states, as unique. In many ways, it isn't. In many ways, the radio things, if you look at Saudi Arabia in the 1960s, builds its largest radio antenna in the world, larger than the Empire State Building, right on its border with Kuwait. Now, why does it do that? Not because anyone in Saudi Arabia lives in that border, because it wants to project its image into and its message into Kuwait.
Makes perfect sense.
And this type of media, you know, has always been there. And again, these are states that may seem like they're authoritarian or may seem to be controlled. But if you're not controlling the media, you're not controlling a whole an important segment of society.
Do these new trends stir up fears in the hearts of some traditionalist of some sort of new colonialism coming over? We tend to think of Saudi Arabia as really traditional, like you said. But there's a commentary I read on Radio Liberty's website that said that the kingdom is backing away from Wahhabism. Is that true?
The kingdom isn't necessarily backing away from Wahhabism. It is probably backing away from a type of certain types of interpretation of Wahhabism. It's worth knowing that the sort of gender-separated issues, the idea that you have a society in which women don't play any public role is actually a product of the 70s. Saudi society didn't look like that before the 1970s, and it's going to look different in the future. One of the things I argue is that not only are there continuities, but there are also evolution over time. In Saudi Arabia, as a society, certainly that's evolving under the current king, who's the most popular in many, many years. He's moved at seemingly glacier pace, but has moved a whole series of things within this society to be frank, to modernize Saudi society. A good example is a new technical school. It's effectively the Saudi Arabia's MIT. And on the campus, both men and women go to school with each other, and women can drive on the campus.
What effect does the presence of U.S. troops in the region have on these new emerging trends, if any?
Oh, enormous. I mean, to begin with, the United States is not only its military, but also its financial, its commercial, its cultural presence, by definition, has an enormous impact. That movie I mentioned, I played Kefal Hall, the first Saudi movie. It opens up in a scene, basically almost out of Spider-Man, and indeed the lead male character wants to be the Godfather, wants to make the Godfather movies. And that by itself is enormous cultural influence. But the presence of military troops is enormously important. It gave these states stability, particularly with much larger states like Iraq and Iran next to them that are stronger. But also, it is a focal point for resistance and rebellion. There is no question that the presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia was one of the key ideological calling cards for al-Qaeda. It was a way of rallying public opinion. If you want to see, there's a great video that's out. It's through the Columbia's Gulf 2000 project. You can see a video that circulated throughout the Middle East just before 9/11 by al-Qaeda. And I can assure you, American troops in Saudi Arabia, particularly close to the two holy cities of Mecca and Medina, plays a prominent role.
This may sound like a petty question, but can female American troops drive in Saudi Arabia now?
Yes, they can. In fact, there's a famous story from 1990 to 91. You hear this in various ways, when both American and Kuwaiti women actually soldiers drove in the kingdom. Yes, absolutely. From what I understand, they did. There's a famous story about a religious police who wanted to enforce strict Wahhabi discipline, saw a woman in public and tried to cane her. Oh. Apparently, she pulled her gun and threatened to shoot him. Apparently, this is a true story. And he had to run away. So yes, women servicemen have served in that part of the world. Women diplomats, from what I understand, do not drive. They have their own drivers.
Okay. What effect, if any, do you see Dubai's enormous debt problems having on these cultural changes? Is it going to put a crimp in their giddy up, so to speak?
Absolutely. Dubai made an enormous amounts of debt, some very, 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 very good bets that went very, very well until last year. And then they went.
Dubai is in the United Arab Emirates, which is one of the six Gulf states.
It's own state, but in reality, it's a large city-state. It's sort of equivalent to talking about New York within the United States as a financial center. Yes, it will have an impact, particularly because Dubai had a model of non-oil development, of integration of non-Muslim populations that was being mimicked certainly over the last 10 years by the other states around it. And as Dubai reinvents itself, that's going to be a model that other states will certainly look at. And indeed, that reinvention will be certainly directed by its neighbor Abu Dhabi, who bailed it out.
Okay. The book is called The Arab Gulf States Beyond Oil and Islam. We could go on easily for another 30 minutes or more, but unfortunately we're out of time. The book is by Dr. Sean Foley. It's from Lynn Renner Press, available Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, all of the...
Or Lynn Renner itself. Or if you want to find me, I have my own website, www.seanfoley.org.
And his email address is sfoley@mtsu.edu. Thanks for being with us, Sean.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can catch the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.